You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has written a major history of American Indians that rebuts the prevalent narrative of our understanding of that history. Since the last major conflict between the U.S. government and Native Americans at Wounded Knee back in 1890, that narrative has been one of tragedy, of loss of way of life and culture. But David Troyer writes that the life of Indians has always been one of adaptation and resilience, from the conflicts over Western expansion and removal, to the first encounters with explorers from Spain, France, and England, to the interactions with other tribes over generations prior to European contact. And the history of Indians since 1890, the resilience, resistance, and ingenuity shown in the face of a government that for most of that time seemed intent on obliterating Indian culture, language, tribal governance, and sovereignty, is something Troyer says should be admired and recognized. The 5.2 million Native Americans living today in the United States deserve a different narrative, one he writes about in his book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present, published by Riverhead Books. David Troyer is an Ojibwe writer and critic from the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. He's the author of four novels and two previous books of nonfiction, and he teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. David Troyer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your book's title, with its nod towards Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, tells a very different history of American Indians than that book. What was the story you wanted to tell?
Well, Dee Brown's book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which was published in 1970 and is still today the best-selling book of American Indian history ever published, relied pretty exclusively, and in this it's not alone, on a tragic narrative that once great tribes were brought low and essentially put in our graves by 1890. And that's the dominant narrative, this tragic telling that's used to think about Native lives. And when I read that book when I was in college, you know, I thought to myself, and I felt very strongly that, well, I'm still here, and my tribe is still here, and we're not merely surviving. We're not simply living some kind of afterlife of perpetual suffering, as the popular culture would have it. We're doing interesting things. My childhood was full of energetic, interesting, flawed, complicated, layered, textured Native people who were busy making their own history. And that's the story I wanted to tell.
I was struck by something you wrote at the very beginning. You said, you know, when I was reading Dee Brown's book, it was like, you know, he made an allusion to this history explains the poverty, the hopelessness, and, you know, what you would see when you saw an American Indian reservation. And he said, this was the place I was pining for. I was on the coast and I was thinking, you know, I want to go back to this home. And you had nothing in common with those descriptors.
No, I mean, Dee Brown says on the very first page of his book, and I don't want to spend all our time trashing Dee Brown. He did an incredible service to Native people by bringing some of our history to light. And he was a sympathetic and committed writer and sympathetic and committed to Native people. But he does say on the very first page, you know, this book is about the Plains Wars, and I start in 1850 and I end at 1890 at the massacre at Wounded Knee, where the culture and civilization of the American Indian was destroyed. That's almost a direct quote. And he goes on, as you know, in the same preface on the next page, to say, so if you happen to travel to a modern Indian reservation and notice the poverty and the hopelessness and the squalor, perhaps by reading my book you will understand why. And as you point out, when I read that book, I was out east. I was in college in New Jersey, and I was homesick. And I wasn't homesick because of the poverty and the hopelessness and the squalor. And I should say that there are very real problems that affect Native communities. We do have problems with poverty. Some people do struggle with hopelessness. These are real things. Those aren't untrue, but they become untrue when we take them as the story of our lives. And I wanted to remind people of the fact that American Indian people aren't merely victims of history. We have, not always with tools of our choosing, not always as we pleased, been able to make our own histories.
Before we talk about some of the stories in the book, how powerful has that tragic narrative been to American Indians' identity?
I think it's, at least, and I can only really speak autobiographically, on that score. But I think that idea that to be Native, to be essentially Native, to be authentically Native was to suffer. And I felt this growing up when we would all meet somebody new and we'd all trade our stories about how hard things are in our res and how dark and how bleak. And we'd talk about the big mistakes we'd made or the extravagances of our uncles, or we'd all trot out our res stories as ways of proving how Native we were by virtue of proving how much we'd suffered. And for myself, I think that tragic narrative is something I bought, that I was trained to accept, that those were the lenses through which I'd been encouraged and trained to see Native life. And it took some time and it took some effort to break out of it.
The heartbeat of Wounded Knee tells a very big story, breaking down the story of 300 plus different groups here in America, indigenous groups, to one story. It's pretty difficult, and it shows up at the early part of the book where you say, I have to take this in sections. You know, every tribe's experience is a little different. And
right.
you tell the story from pre-European incursion through their first encounters with Europeans.
Yeah, that's right. And it's especially true for in Oklahoma,
yes,
which is saturated with Native people, all of whom represent collectively thousands upon thousands of diverse experiences of both America and being Native in America. And you probably know that better than anyone. And most of the people, most of your listeners are probably going to understand that intuitively, that there is no story of Native American life. There are only stories of Native American lives.
How did you go about trying to tell this story and organize this story?
Well, I'd always thought I would begin the book in 1890. My goal was to write a follow-up and counter-narrative to Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. My goal was to start where he stopped, to start at the moment in which everyone thought we were dead and gone, and to tell the story of Native lives from then up to the present. And so when I sat down to write the book, I meant to start in 1890. And I looked out and I sort of surveyed that moment, and I thought to myself, well, a little backstory seems important so people understand why 1890 looked and felt the way it did. And so then I kept rolling backwards to see, well, I should start here, or maybe I should start with the removal of the five civilized tribes from the southeast United States, or maybe I should start from, and I ended up going 20,000 BC. And my editor was a little alarmed, but she has maybe too much faith in me, and she said, go with it. If you think it needs to happen, let's see how it looks. And then she read it, and she said, yeah, we need this. We need the backstory.
Well, 1890 comes at about page 100 in the narrative.
Right, I know. And then moving forward, the way I really organized it was, and I was really clear about this for myself, I knew I wanted to write a book about Native life rather than Native death. And in order to do that, the only way I could imagine doing that was to talk to people, to go out and about and go visiting in New Mexico and Arizona and Montana and Colorado and North Dakota and South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, California, Florida, New York. I had to go visit and talk to people. And I remember I talked to this one Blackfeet guy named Red Hall, and we met in Browning, and we sit down, and he's kind of curious as to why I want to talk to him. And he's this gruff old fiddle-playing cowboy railroad worker guy in his 80s. And he says, well, I'm pretty good after 1934. Before that, I don't know a whole lot. And why do you want to talk to me anyway? And he was struggling for words, but he was trying to say that he wasn't an expert in anything. And I said, Red, I'm touched and honored you want to hang out and you want to talk. And the fact is, you are an expert. You are an expert on what it felt like to grow up Blackfeet in the 40s and 50s. I'm not an expert in that, but you are. And that's what I want to know. What was life like? What did it feel like? What did you do? How did you get married? Where did you find work? Those are the things I'm curious about. And so the whole book is really built around the expertise and the knowledge and the stories of myriad Native people, from young to old and women to men and traditional to Christian and professionals and unprofessionals. And that's the backbone of the book.
That is a time when the government seemed to be dismantling what remained of Indian culture, or as a byproduct of their policy, it was about dismantling the culture. It's a time of Indian schools. It's a time of termination, of ending a tribal group's recognition and just becoming American. And I think it was him that said, you know, this is the byproduct was at the same time of war and Indian schools. It said, you know, it actually gave us a larger sense of identity because we were no longer a Blackfoot and maybe an American, but now we're a Blackfoot, an Indian, and an American.
Yeah, I think that was Red that pointed that out. And that's one of the things I try to discuss in the book or try to show that despite the government's best efforts to dismantle tribes, because the government wanted to get out of the Indian business. They wanted to be free of their treaty obligations to sovereign Indian nations. And so they tried a number of different ways to do this. They tried allotment policy starting in the late 1880s, early 1890s, where they would break up tribal landholdings and allot individual parcels to individual people. They tried residential boarding schools where native kids were often forcibly removed from their homes, certainly coerced in most instances, to attend federally funded religious boarding schools where they were whitewashed, or the attempt was made to whitewash them. And this happened again in the post-war years, in the 1950s, when the government tried to terminate reservations. And all of this was meant to mainstream Indians. This idea of American exceptionalism, that the American way is the only way, that we have a melting pot, that we have a meritocracy, that free market capitalism mixed with representative democracy is not only a way, it is the only way to organize one's country and one's culture, the pursuit of wealth, the private ownership of property. These are the articles of the Constitution, which aren't entirely written out, at least not there, but those are the bylaws of the country. And at every turn, Native people sort of suffered through these policies and found ways to resist, found ways to remain both as Indian individuals and as Native tribes. And we became stronger as a result.
I want to ask you about some of those stories of resilience and resistance. I think one of the coolest things you did is you relate full sections of speeches, like Chief Joseph's speech after he surrendered. I believe he was in Washington. It's the full speech of, you know, his own personal feeling of being a man, of being a person, living in what is now the United States. But the person I want to ask about is the other person you sort of document at the same time, and that is Standing Bear, the leader of the Poncas, who went on this journey from the reservation here in what was then Indian Territory here in northern Oklahoma to take his son's remains to their ancestral grounds, the place they lived along the Niobrara River up in northern Nebraska. And the story you're telling is of his way of working through our courts to be known as a person within the United States.
That's a beautiful and painful story. And his descendants are very much, very much alive and active and invested in, I think and many of them live in Oklahoma.
Right.
And also Nebraska. And his story is so profoundly powerful that all he wanted to do was to return to his tribal homeland to fulfill his promise to his son that he'd be buried in the land of his ancestors. He was intercepted along the way and then detained and charged with, and I forget the exact nature of the crime, and he, with allies, took his case to court. And I include so much of that court battle because he ended up arguing and ended up winning his case. And he was arguing that he is a human being and entitled to all the rights that derived therefrom, like anyone else.
In a time when most Indians weren't citizens.
Yeah. But not only not citizens, but not even accorded the same rights that visiting foreigners were accorded in the United States. So it was doubly and deeply both ironic and painful that not only were Native Americans not citizens, and there wasn't any consensus on whether we wanted to be at that time, but we couldn't even freely move about the country like any visitor from Japan or Germany or France could. And he won. And it was an important case. And it was also an important cultural moment, I think, for Native people. And I don't know how well known that moment is now.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad I was able to include it in the book, because one of the side effects of working on a book like this, that's this big for this long, is that I feel like I'm going back to school, because I didn't know about Standing Bear when I started writing the book. And I happened on the case and on the testimony, and I began reading it, and I get to learn from the historical record, but I get to learn from the example of all of these leaders, some of whom are famous, like Chief Joseph, some of whom aren't, like standing there, but, you know, all of whom are inspiring. And I get to learn from the people I talk to on the road, and it's a wonderful feeling at, you know, my late age of 48 to feel like I'm the student again. It's a good feeling.
I have to ask about another tribe with Oklahoma ties, the Chickasaw. And this gets into the idea of, well, the government was going around destroying tribal governments in the late 1800s at the time of allotment. And the Chickasaws found a great way to counteract that. That was to win offices and run towns and run governments within their territorial area, within civil government, within the state government and federal government.
Oh yeah, it was ironic that, you know, after being forcibly removed from, along with the other so-called civilized tribes, which, you know, if you're not from one of those five tribes, we think civilized, you know, can't we extend that to all of us? But after being forcibly removed from the southeastern United States and enduring the Trail of Tears, and then, you know, enduring the multiple land grabs that occurred in and around, you know, Oklahoma statehood and all of that, after dealing with all of that, you know, the Chickasaw, among others, were incredibly successful at starting their own schools, using the Chickasaw language, and government officials, well, this isn't good, this isn't right, and they try to destroy these self-governing, self-sufficient communities. And one way in which people, once again, fought the government was by taking control of local school boards and running in mayoral races and running for county commissioners and running for and winning all sorts of local offices and thereby charting their own future. And there's also, and I wasn't able to describe this much in the book, but after all the Oklahoma land grabs and after many Native people were dispossessed, a lot of Native people from Indian territories decided that their best bet was not to try and reside in America as Native people, at least legally, but to join the successive waves of homesteaders and go out and homestead just like any other Americans could, or even immigrants could. And so there was this huge diaspora from Indian territories out through Kansas and Nebraska and Colorado. You had all of these Cherokees and other people from Indian territory moving out and staking claims with homesteaders just like anyone else would and working the land for 7 years, and the title passed to them. And they found a way to work the system. And there are all these interesting choices that people made in response to the ongoing pressure and sort of terrorism, if you will, of the federal government.
That diaspora that you mentioned, some of it was actual self-decisions made by people to leave. Others were encouraged by the government, the forced relocation of moving Indians to urban areas. He said what's really interesting is that every incidence where the government took an action, say residential Indian schools, the allotment policy, the termination movement to terminate reservations or urban relocation, they always had a byproduct that was, again, sort of a resilience on the part of Indians. What was, say, in the diaspora and the relocation, what was the byproduct there?
Well, you know, you're talking about federal policy of termination and its sort of companion policy of relocation. The idea was that Indians suffered all sorts of social problems because we were stuck in these backwaters and these backwards reservations and tribal communities. And the best thing to do was to just get rid of those and to encourage us to move to cities along with, you know, the majority of the American population, which was shifting from rural to urban areas, you know, from the First World War up through the 1950s. And so there was this relocation program where Indians were encouraged to move to cities and were promised housing and education and job training opportunities, very little of which materialized. And then you had all these Native people from all these different tribes packed into huge urban areas like Los Angeles, Chicago, Oklahoma City, Denver, Minneapolis, Cleveland, places like that. And they found each other, they learned from each other, they built networks, family networks, professional networks, and they didn't all lose their connection to their tribal communities, which weren't destroyed in their absence. And they sort of brought their experience of modern urban America into contact with reservation life, and reservation folks brought their tribal prerogatives into contact with urban populations, and we were better equipped to deal with the modern moment in which we find ourselves.
As the book progresses and you get into more contemporary history, you do illustrate all of the history with personal stories. You mentioned Red, the Blackfoot that you talked to in Montana. Who were some of the most interesting people that you met that sort of gave you really interesting insight on contemporary Indian life?
Gosh, there's a guy named Dave Schilt, also Blackfeet, but who moved to the Bay Area, and he's working out there, former bull and bronc rider. He was fascinating to talk to. He went through relocation. He and his family moved to Los Angeles when he was in middle school. And I learned a lot about how difficult that was, but also how he found parts of himself there too. So I got this really human picture of relocation from Dave. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I got to talk to this woman from Fond du Lac Reservation in Minnesota, Sarah Agaton Howes, who was in terrible health. And her prospects of living a long, happy life were complicated by the likelihood of her developing diabetes and so on. And she just kind of fell into exercising and running and has become an ultramarathon runner in a way that sort of recovers tribal understandings of running and women's power. And by connecting to her tribal patrimony in relation to running, she's sort of made a huge change in her community in a very modern way. So I don't know. I got to talk to so many interesting, cool people.
You tell the story of the American Indian movement. Your point of view seems very ambivalent. Obviously, AIM helped make Indians more visible in a culture which had almost forgotten them, yet their tendency towards violence, misogyny, they did good work, and I guess from your readings, some work that was not so great.
Yeah, I mean, I had a mission in this book, and like I mentioned, I wanted to write a follow-up and counter-narrative to Dee Brown's book, and I didn't want to just write an alternative history. I didn't just want to include different names and different dates and different facts. I wanted a whole new way of telling Native stories. And to me, the opposite of a tragic telling is not a story of hope. Those are just two sides of the same coin. And that's a currency that we've been paying out our lives in, you know, ever since the beginning. To me, tragedy eradicates complexity, and it just turns us into our lives into a condition that is understood through dire statistics. That's what tragedy does. It turns us into statistics and a condition. The opposite of that, the opposite of tragedy, in my opinion, is a story of complexity, of depth, of layers, of texture. And so that's my mission. And so when I really looked hard at Native American activism in the 60s and 70s, I don't think my book is served, but I don't know that we're served by glossing over some of the excesses of AIM's leadership. I'm thinking of Dennis Banks and Russell Means in particular, and only focusing on their rhetoric. I thought we should pay attention to their actions, too. And the American Indian Movement in those years was complicated, as you point out. It did some amazing things. It started schools run by and for Native people in cities like Minneapolis, schools which are still going. They started neighborhood patrols to police the police, to crack down on and cut back on police brutality. Those were very important. They started health clinics. They started job training centers. They did amazing things on some levels. And on other levels, a little less so. There was, as you point out, some misogyny in the American Indian movement. There was a lot of violence that dogged the movement that was ultimately, I think, really destructive. And it's important to notice that. It's important to notice the complexity of that. If our future movements are going to be any better. And that's why I'm so encouraged by, the movement at Standing Rock to fight the pipeline. Although it wasn't locally successful in stopping that particular pipeline, they managed to sort of engage in it in sort of, I think, a 15-month protest. It might have been longer. That was nonviolent, that was equitable, where misogyny was not the watchword, where there were women and men in positions of leadership, not just men. You know, a movement that was able to build coalitions between Natives and non-Natives and across tribes around the country and united urban Native people and reservation Native people and suburban Native people, because we exist too. right. and in ways that I think are ultimately going to be very successful because they're still at work stopping other pipelines in other places.
You write at the end of the book, to know America, you have to look at Indian history and the Indian present. And I guess my question is that what we'll find when we do this story that you...
I hope so.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's a tendency to treat Native American history as a sideshow. There's a kind of liberal urge to tune into Native stories as a kind of community service. And it lets people off the hook because people can tune in and experience intense emotions and then move on. And the status quo does not change. And in my opinion, the status quo needs changing. But I think the fact is you can't really understand the country without thinking about Native people. For instance, America's first revolutionary act was to throw tea in Boston Harbor, but they didn't merely throw tea in Boston Harbor. They dressed up as Mohawk Indians and then dumped tea. That's important to remember, because if you remember that, you can also remember that when the United States was searching around for constitutional and democratic models, they discovered the Iroquois Confederacy and modeled a lot of our country's governmental structure and the balance of power on that Confederacy. You can't understand American government without looking at American Indian government. You can't understand the complicated relationship between federal and state power without thinking about the removal of the five civilized tribes from the Southeast in the early 19th century, because that was our first test of the relationship between the federal government and the states, and it was fought in relation to tribal rights and tribal nations. And the list goes on, and if you don't believe me, you can note that in the 1980s and 1990s, the Supreme Court heard more cases about federal Indian law than any other genre of law, more than banking law, more than immigration law, more than reproductive rights. In the years after Watergate and the Pentagon Papers and the Vietnam War, as the country tried to rethink what it was, what it meant, at least in the courts, it did so in relation to us and our presence. But the fact is, there's been a civil war raging in this country since its earliest days that continues on, and it seems that there's no sign of it abating. And that war is about what kind of country do we want to be? Do we want to be a country that, in the words of Ronald Reagan, where people can still get rich? Or do we want to be a country that supports and encourages and protects its weakest citizens, the poor, ethnic minorities, for example, so that we all do better? Is our government's purpose to get out of the way so the 1% can get richer and so we can still persist in the fantasy that we live in a meritocracy? Or is the government's purpose to protect its citizens collectively? And that war has been going since the beginning. How are we going to define ourselves? By America's worst actions or by its written and stated ideals and its founding documents? And Native people have been at the center of that conflict since the very beginning. So that's the big point of the book. We're not a sideshow. We are central to the show that is this country.
David Troyer is a Ojibwe writer and critic and a professor of literature and creative writing at USC, and he's the author of The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present, published by Riverhead. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.